A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been digging into the mechanics of customs clearance and B2B importing, and he hit the thing that trips up basically everyone the first time they deal with it. You're shipping a product, you look at the HS code, the harmonized system classification number, and you think, well, this is obvious. It's a plastic widget. It's a chair. It's a t-shirt. And then customs sends back a notice saying, no, actually, that chair is upholstered seating, and you owe 8.5%, not zero. Your shipment's held. Your margin's gone. And if you're on a DDP deal where you as the seller are paying the duty, that error just came straight out of your pocket.
The thing that makes this so brutal is the timing. You don't find out at the point of sale. You find out when the container's already at the port, storage charges are accruing by the day, and your buyer is asking where their goods are. That's when you learn that the 6-digit code you thought was universal.
Daniel's question is essentially, what is this system? Why isn't it as standardized as it claims to be? And where does the real value of a customs broker actually live? Because he's looking at these tariff documents and realizing the international standard part has some pretty large asterisks attached.
It really does. And I think the best way into this is to picture what the harmonized system is supposed to be in theory, before we get into where it breaks. The World Customs Organization in Brussels maintains this. It's a hierarchical numbering system, 6 digits at the international level, covering basically every physical good that crosses a border. Over 200 countries use it. The promise is that a bicycle in China is the same 6-digit code as a bicycle in Brazil. That's the universal language pitch. The reality is that after those 6 digits, every country bolts on its own extension. The US runs the Harmonized Tariff Schedule, HTS-US, which goes to 10 digits. The EU uses combined nomenclature codes at 8 digits. China has a 13-digit beast, and those extra digits aren't just statistical footnotes, they're where the actual duty rates live. So, the universal part stops at 6, and everything after that is national policy, national interpretation, and national revenue collection.
It's less a universal language and more a shared alphabet with very different sentences being written.
And even within the shared 6 digits, the interpretation diverges. The World Customs Organization publishes explanatory notes, but they're not legally binding. Countries issue their own rulings. A customs officer in Rotterdam might classify a product one way, and a customs officer in Los Angeles might classify the same product differently, using the same 6-digit heading.
Which is where the broker earns their fee, because they know which port interprets what, how. But before we get to the broker's value, let's talk about what actually governs classification, because Daniel mentioned the self-explanatory trap, and that's the thing that catches people.
Right, most importers never learn that there are 6 legal rules governing how you classify anything under the HS. They're called the General Rules of Interpretation, the GIRs, and they're applied in sequence. Rule 1 says you start with the actual text of the headings and any chapter or section notes. If the heading says bicycles and your product is a bicycle, you're done. But it almost never is that clean.
Because most products could plausibly fit under multiple headings.
And that's where Rule 3 kicks in. When goods are prima facie classifiable under 2 or more headings, you have to determine which one provides the most specific description. And if that doesn't resolve it, you apply the essential character test, Rule 3B.
Give me an example of essential character going wrong.
Classic one, a smartphone sold with a leather case. Is it a phone under heading 8517, or is it leather goods under 4202? The phone gives it essential character, most customs authorities agree on that. But now change the case to something elaborate. A designer hand-stitched leather folio that costs more than the phone. Some jurisdictions will flip the classification. Same 2 items, same 6-digit headings, different outcome depending on where you clear customs.
The importer who looked this up on a free online tool probably got the generic code for mobile phone and never considered the case at all.
That's the free tool problem in a nutshell. Those tools give you the obvious answer. They don't walk you through the GIRs. They don't ask whether your product is a composite good, a set, a part, or an accessory. And those distinctions matter enormously. A car sunroof, is it a part of the vehicle or an accessory? The duty rate can be wildly different. A chocolate bar with a toy inside, is it food or is it a toy? Different regulatory regimes, different duties, different everything.
Daniel mentioned the frozen French fry problem. I want to sit with that one because it's so perfectly absurd.
It's my favorite example of how counterintuitive this gets. A company imports frozen French fries and classifies them under heading 2004.10, prepared vegetables, duty rate around 14.4%. They've been doing this for 2 years. Customs audits them and says, no, these are frozen vegetables, heading 07-10.10, duty rate 4.8%. Now, you'd think the importer would be thrilled they've been overpaying. But here's the catch, they declared the wrong code. Even though they paid more than they needed to, they made an incorrect declaration, which means penalties. And the overpaid duty? Getting that back is a separate administrative battle that can take years.
They paid too much, and they're still in trouble.
They paid too much. They're facing penalties for incorrect declaration, and their compliance record now has a red flag that makes every future shipment more likely to be inspected. All because frozen potato product sounds like one thing to a layperson, but is legally two different things depending on whether the potato has been prepared or simply frozen.
That's the part that I think Daniel's really getting at. The gap between what seems self-explanatory and what the system actually demands. And it's not just food. The LED lamp problem is another one.
Right, is an LED lamp a lighting fixture under heading 9405, or is it an electrical machine under heading 8543? The answer often depends on whether the LED is integrated or replaceable. If it's integrated, some countries say it's an electronic device, not a lamp. If it's replaceable, it's a lamp. Same product category, same basic function, light comes out, but the tariff treatment diverges based on a design detail that the importer might not even think to mention to their broker.
The importer filling out the commercial invoice is probably just writing LED lamp and assuming that's enough.
Which brings us to another trap. The description you put on the invoice matters enormously. Customs isn't looking at your product, they're looking at the paperwork. If your invoice says plastic widget and the physical item has a metal bracket that makes it a machinery part, the customs computer is going to flag it based on what the invoice description most closely matches in their reference database. And once it's flagged, the burden of proof shifts to you.
Let's talk about how this plays out across borders, because Daniel specifically asked about the similarity, or lack of it, between different country systems. The six-digit base is the same.
After that, it fragments fast. The US HTSUs goes to 10 digits, and the last four determine the actual duty rate. The EU CN code goes to 8 digits, and then individual EU member states can add further subdivisions for their own statistical purposes. China's system goes to 13 digits and includes import and export licensing controls baked into the code structure. So even if you and your supplier agree on the six-digit heading, the national extension in their country might classify the product under a different subheading than the extension in yours.
Those subheadings carry different duty rates.
Take scented candles. In the US, they're generally classified as candles under heading 3406. In some EU member states, they've been classified as miscellaneous chemical products under heading 3824 because the scent is considered the essential character. Different duty rate, different regulatory requirements, and potentially different anti-dumping regimes if the candles are coming from certain countries.
The same product, same six-digit base, but the national interpretation flips it into a completely different regulatory bucket.
This is where binding tariff information rulings come in. In the EU, you can apply for a BTI, an official ruling on how your specific product should be classified. In the US, it's called a binding ruling. These are legally binding on customs authorities in the issuing country. If you get a BTI from German Customs saying your scented candle is heading 3406, German Customs can't later reclassify it. But here's the catch, that BTI is only valid in Germany. If you then ship to France, French Customs can say, we disagree, and classify it differently.
You'd need a separate BTI for every EU member state you import into?
In theory, the EU's combined nomenclature is supposed to be uniform, and a BTI issued by one member state is binding across the EU. But in practice, the interpretation of the BTI scope can vary. And a BTI from Germany definitely doesn't protect you in China or the US. So if you're an importer bringing goods from China into the US and also into the EU, you need separate rulings in each jurisdiction, and they might not agree with each other.
Which is where the customs broker's real expertise comes in. They're not just looking up codes. They're maintaining libraries of past rulings. They know which ports have which interpretive tendencies. And they can argue the nuances of GIR6, the subheading level classification rules, that most importers don't even know exist.
GIR6 is the one that governs classification at the subheading level, and it's where a lot of disputes are won or lost. It says you compare subheadings at the same level and determine which one is most specific. But most specific is a judgment call. A broker who's been doing this for 20 years in a specific industry knows exactly how customs officials at a given port have ruled on that judgment call in the past.
The cost of getting it wrong is not just the duty difference. Under U.S. law, specifically 19 U.S.C. 1592, penalties for underpayment can reach 2 times the duty owed. And that's before we even talk about non-tariff barriers. FDA holds if the misclassification triggers a different regulatory regime, anti-dumping duties if the product gets swept into a trade dispute, quota restrictions if the code falls under a limited category.
There's a real case that illustrates this perfectly. A furniture importer brought in wooden chairs with upholstered seats and classified them as wooden furniture under heading 940169 Duty Rate 0%. Customs reclassified them as upholstered seats under heading 940171, duty rate 8.5%. The importer owed $340,000 in back duties, plus penalties. The difference between 0% and 8.5% was a single digit in the HS code, and it was determined by whether the upholstery or the wood frame gave the chair its essential character.
On a DDP deal, that $340,000 comes straight out of the seller's margin. The buyer's already paid the invoice. The goods are delivered, duty paid. The seller eats the reclassification.
Here's the part that really stings. If the buyer nominated the customs broker under DDP, the seller might not even have direct contact with the person making the classification decision. The buyer's broker files the entry, the seller gets the duty bill, and if there's an error, the seller is still ultimately responsible for the correct declaration in most jurisdictions. The contract might give you recourse against the broker, but good luck enforcing that across borders while your shipment is sitting in a bonded warehouse accruing storage fees.
The practical takeaway, even before we get to the detailed advice, is if you are selling on DDP terms, you need contractual language that gives you the right to review the broker's classification before the entry is filed. If you don't have that, you're writing a blank check.
That's really the core of what Daniel's asking about. The HS system is an extraordinary achievement in international coordination. 200-plus countries agreeing on a common taxonomy for traded goods is genuinely impressive. But the standardization is incomplete, the interpretation is inconsistent, and the financial stakes of getting it wrong are enormous. The value of a customs broker isn't that they have access to a secret database of correct codes. It's that they understand the rules of interpretation, they know the classification culture of specific ports and countries, and they can anticipate where the disputes will arise before the shipment is flagged.
Which means the self-explanatory HS code is a myth. What looks obvious to the person selling the product is often wrong, and the system is designed around legal rules, the GIRs, that most importers don't know exist until they're on the wrong end of a customs audit.
That audit can come years after the shipment cleared. Customs authorities in most countries have several years to review entries and issue demands for back duties. So, the error you make today might not surface until your product line has changed, your margins have shifted, and the money you thought you made on those sales is long since spent.
The system is supposed to be a universal language, but it's more like a language with 6 shared root words, and then every country writes its own poetry. And if you get the poem wrong, they fine you.
Actually, a pretty good way to put it. And the poets are customs officers who've been reading these rules for decades and have very specific ideas about what a chair is. The thing is, the system actually is remarkable when you step back and look at what it achieves. The World Customs Organization in Brussels maintains this taxonomy. 97 chapters covering everything from live animals to fine art, organized in a hierarchy that gets more specific as you go down. 2 digits for the chapter, 4 for the heading, 6 for the subheading. Over 200 countries have signed on. That's a genuine feat of international coordination.
The first 6 digits really are the same everywhere. A bicycle heading is 87.12, whether you're in China, Brazil, or Germany.
The core promise holds at 6 digits. Chapter 87 is vehicles, heading 12 is bicycles and other cycles, and the subheading narrows it to motorized or not. That part is universal. The World Customs Organization updates it every 5 years. Next revision is 2027, and member countries negotiate the changes. It's slow, bureaucratic, and surprisingly functional.
Then every country grabs that 6-digit base and extends it.
The U.S. Harmonized Tariff Schedule adds 4 more digits, so you get a 10-digit code. Those extra digits aren't just for statistics, they're where the actual duty rate lives. The EU's combined nomenclature goes to 8 digits, and individual member states can tack on more for their own tracking. China runs a 13-digit system that folds in import and export licensing controls directly into the code structure. So the universal language stops being universal at digit 7.
Which means if you are an importer moving goods from China to the US, your supplier in Shenzhen might be using a 13-digit Chinese export code that doesn't map cleanly to the 10-digit HTS US code you need at the port of Los Angeles. Same 6-digit base, completely different downstream classification.
That mismatch is where a lot of the friction lives. The supplier thinks they're shipping one thing because their domestic classification system says so. The US Customs computer reads the invoice description and matches it to a different 10-digit code. The importer is in the middle, and the shipment is held until someone sorts out which code is correct, or at least defensible.
The mismatch problem is really just the surface. The deeper issue is that, even when you've got the right 6-digit heading, the legal rules that determine which subheading applies are not intuitive. You mentioned the GIRs earlier, the General Rules of Interpretation. Most importers don't know these exist.
They're the whole game. 6 rules, applied in strict sequence. Rule 1 says you start with the actual text of the headings in any chapter or section notes. If the heading describes your product, you're done. The notes matter enormously because they define exclusions. Chapter 61 covers knitted clothing, but the notes tell you exactly what counts as knitted versus woven. Rule 2 handles incomplete or unfinished goods, and goods presented unassembled or disassembled. So if you ship a bicycle in a flat box, it's still classified as a bicycle, not as miscellaneous metal tubes. But the rule has limits. The incomplete article has to have the essential character of the finished product.
Which sounds straightforward until you're the one arguing with a customs officer about whether a shipment of circuit boards with no processors has the essential character of a computer.
And that brings us to Rule 3, where most disputes actually live. When goods are prima facie classifiable under 2 or more headings, Rule 3 tells you how to break the tie. 3A says pick the most specific description. Electric razor beats electrical appliance. 3B, the essential character test, kicks in when specificity doesn't resolve it.
Walk me through essential character with something that actually trips people up.
A chocolate bar with a toy inside. Heading 1806 is chocolate. Heading 9503 is toys. The toy isn't just packaging, it's part of the product's appeal. So which gives essential character? Most customs authorities look at what the consumer is primarily buying. If it's a Kinder egg, the chocolate dominates. If it's a plastic dinosaur with a tiny chocolate pellet attached, the toy dominates. But there's a gray zone in the middle where reasonable people disagree.
Reasonable people disagree. In customs means your shipment is held, and you're paying storage fees while lawyers argue about a chocolate bar.
The LED lamp is an even better example because it splits countries. An LED lamp with an integrated, non-replaceable bulb, is that a lighting fixture under heading 9405 or an electrical machine under heading 8543? The EU has generally classified integrated LED luminaires as lighting fixtures. Some other jurisdictions have said no. If the LED is permanently attached, it's an electronic device, not a traditional lamp. Same product, same 6-digit heading, different 8 and 10-digit outcomes.
The duty difference?
Can be substantial. Lighting fixtures might face 3-5%. Electrical machines could be 0-2.5% depending on the country. But the bigger risk is non-tariff. Lighting fixtures often have separate safety certification requirements, energy efficiency labeling rules, and different anti-dumping duty exposure. Misclassify it and you're not just paying the wrong rate, you might be missing mandatory compliance documentation entirely.
Which brings us to the frozen French fry case, which I think is the perfect illustration of how self-explanatory classification fails.
It's almost beautiful in its absurdity. Heading 2004.10 covers prepared or preserved potatoes. That means cooked, fried, or otherwise processed beyond simple freezing. Heading 0710.10 covers frozen vegetables, uncooked or merely blanched. The distinction is whether the potato has been parfried. If the factory blanches and freezes, it's 0710. If it parfries before freezing, it's 2004. The duty difference was about 10 percentage points.
The importer who got this wrong was overpaying by 10% for 2 years.
14.4% when they should have been paying 4.8. But here's what makes it so instructive. They weren't trying to evade duties. They were paying more than required, they just used the wrong code. And Customs still penalized them for incorrect declaration, because the system cares about accuracy, not just revenue. You can't defend yourself by saying, "But I paid too much." The declaration was false, and that's what triggers the penalties.
The lesson is that guessing conservatively, picking the higher duty code to be safe, doesn't actually protect you.
It might even make things worse, because it signals to Customs that you don't know how to classify your own products. And once you're flagged for incorrect declarations, every future entry gets scrutinized. The audit window in the U.S. is typically 5 years. In some countries, it's longer, so the error compounds.
Another trap Daniel's likely to hit, parts versus accessories. You mentioned the car's sunroof.
Parts are integral to the functioning of the thing. Accessories are optional additions that enhance or supplement. A replacement engine valve is a part. A sunroof is it integral to the car's function. In some classification rulings, yes, if it's factory installed and the vehicle is designed around it. In others, it's an accessory because the car functions perfectly well without it. The same physical item can flip categories based on how it's sold, as original equipment or aftermarket.
The duty rate on auto parts versus auto accessories can be completely different.
Parts might enter duty-free under certain trade agreements. Accessories might face 6-8%. And the classification can also determine whether the item qualifies for preferential tariff treatment under a free trade agreement, which requires the correct HS code to claim.
What about functional units? You mentioned a 3D printer with an integrated scanner.
This is Rule 3C and the functional unit concept. When a machine consists of individual components intended to contribute together to a clearly defined function, the whole thing is classified under the heading appropriate to that function. A 3D printer with a scanner, is the scanner just an input device for the printer, making the whole thing a 3D printer under heading 8485? Or is it a multifunction machine where the scanner has independent utility? The answer depends on whether the scanner can function without the printer. If it can scan and save files independently, some customs authorities will classify the scanner and printer separately, with different duty rates for each component.
Even though they're sold as one machine in one box.
And if the invoice doesn't break out the value of each component, customs may do it for you, using their own valuation methodology, which is rarely favorable to the importer. This is where the international divergence really gets wild. Even with the same six-digit base, countries just go their own way. Take scented candles. In the U.S., they're candles, heading 3406. In some EU member states, customs has ruled their miscellaneous chemical products under heading 3824 because the scent compound is considered the essential character, not the wax.
The same jar of vanilla-scented wax crosses the Atlantic and becomes a completely different legal object.
With different duty rates, different regulatory requirements, and potentially different anti-dumping exposure. If you're importing scented candles from a country with anti-dumping duties on chemical products, but not on candles, that reclassification just made your shipment economically non-viable.
The importer who looked up the code on a free website probably got candle and moved on with their life.
Until the customs computer in Rotterdam flags it. And here's the thing about those free lookup tools. They give you the obvious six-digit heading. They don't tell you that French customs has a different interpretation than German customs on where scented candles land. They don't mention that the EU's binding tariff information system exists at all.
Explain BTI, because this is one of those things that sounds bureaucratic, but is actually a genuine risk management tool.
Binding tariff information is an official ruling you can request from EU customs authorities. You submit a sample or detailed description of your product, and they issue a legally binding decision on its classification. Once you have a BTI, customs in the issuing country can't reclassify that product on you. It's valid across the EU in principle. A BTI from Germany should be respected in France. In practice, the interpretation of the ruling scope can vary, and you might still face challenges at different ports.
In the US, the equivalent is a binding ruling from Customs and Border Protection.
You apply, they rule, and that ruling binds CBP at every US port. But here's the crucial limitation. A BTI from Germany doesn't protect you in China. A binding ruling from the US doesn't help you in Brazil. These rulings are jurisdiction specific. If you're importing into three countries, you need three separate rulings, and they may not agree with each other.
Which is where the customs broker earns whatever they're charging. They're not just filing paperwork. They maintain libraries of past rulings, their own and their competitors, and they know the classification culture at specific ports.
Port-level culture is a real thing. Some ports are known for aggressive classification enforcement on textiles. Others scrutinize electronics more heavily. A broker who's been clearing goods through Long Beach for 15 years knows exactly which headings trigger automatic holds and which ones sail through. They know which customs officers have ruled which way on GIR6 subheading comparisons. That knowledge isn't written down anywhere public.
GIR6, the subheading level rule, is where a lot of the broker's value lives, because that's the one that governs how you pick between two subheadings at the same level.
It says you compare them as if they're equally specific, then pick the one that best describes the goods. Best describes is a judgment call. A broker who specializes in your industry has seen that judgment call made 50 times and knows which arguments actually persuade customs officials.
Let's put a number on what getting it wrong costs, because the penalties are not subtle. Under U.S. law, 19 U.S.C., 1592, underpayment of duties can trigger penalties up to 2 times the duty owed. And that's just the penalty. You still owe the back duties.
The furniture case is the one that sticks with me. An importer brought in wooden chairs with upholstered seats and classified them as wooden furniture, heading 940169, duty rate 0%. Customs reclassified them as upholstered seats, heading 940171, duty rate 8.5%. The importer owed $340,000 in back duties plus penalties.
The difference between 0% and 8.5% was whether the wood frame or the fabric seat gave the chair its essential character.
One digit in the HS code. And this wasn't some fly-by-night operation trying to dodge duties. They believed wooden chairs with fabric seats for wooden furniture. It's an intuitive classification. It's also wrong.
If that shipment was on DDP terms, the seller eats the entire $340,000. The buyer's invoice is paid. The goods are delivered duty paid. The seller has no way to pass that cost through.
Here's the DDP nightmare scenario. The buyer nominates the customs broker. The seller has no direct relationship with that broker, no visibility into what code they're filing. The broker classifies aggressively, or just carelessly, and the entry goes through. 2 years later, customs audits and reclassifies. The seller gets the bill. The buyer's broker says, "We filed what we thought was correct." The seller has limited recourse, especially across borders.
The seller's margin is exposed to a classification decision made by someone they didn't hire, didn't brief, and can't easily sue.
The audit window in the U.S. is 5 years. In some jurisdictions, it's longer. That error from 2024 might surface in 2029, long after the product line has changed and the money from those sales is gone.
Which is why the contractual language matters. If you're selling DDP, you need the right to review the broker's classification before the entry is filed.
You need a broker who knows your industry specifically, not a generalist. The difference between a 0% duty rate and an 8.5% rate is often a single digit in a 10-digit code, and only someone who lives in that chapter of the tariff schedule day in and day out is going to spot the risk before it becomes a liability. If you're actually doing this, if you're importing and you're staring at a commercial invoice trying to figure out what code to put down, where do you start? What's the thing you do next week?
First thing, never assume the code is obvious. run what I'd call a GIR sanity check. You've got the product in front of you. Before you type anything into a lookup tool, read the actual text of the heading you think applies, and read the chapter notes. The notes are where the exclusions live. If chapter 61 says this chapter does not cover garments with less than 5% elastomeric yarn, and your t-shirt has 8% spandex, you're in the wrong chapter. That's rule one. It takes 10 minutes, and it catches the mistakes that free tools miss.
Then ask yourself, could this product plausibly fit under two headings? If the answer is yes, you're in Rule 3 territory, and you need to figure out which heading is more specific, or which component gives the thing its essential character. If you can't answer that confidently, you need a broker, not a website.
Second thing, and this one's specific to DDP sellers, get the right to review classification before the entry is filed. Put it in the contract. If the buyer is nominating the broker, you need a clause that says the broker's proposed HS code comes to you for approval at least 48 hours before the shipment files. If they push back, remind them that you're the one on the hook for the duty and the penalties.
If they still push back, price that risk into the deal or walk away. A DDP contract without classification review rights is a liability with a purchase order attached.
Third, build a classification library. For every SKU you ship, get a binding ruling from CBP if you're importing into the US, or a BTI if you're in the EU. And set a calendar reminder for 2027, because that's when the WCO's next 5-year HS revision drops, and some of your codes will change. If you're still using a 2022 ruling in 2028, you're gambling.
The 2027 revision is going to be a big one, actually. New headings for electric vehicles, advanced battery chemistries, AI hardware, whole categories of goods that barely existed when the last revision was negotiated. If you're importing anything in the EV supply chain, your classification library needs to be ready to update.
Fourth, and this sounds obvious, but people resist it, hire a licensed customs broker who specializes in your industry. Not a generalist, not the cheapest option on Freightos, someone who lives in your specific tariff chapters. The furniture importer who got hit for $340,000 probably had a broker. They just didn't have one who knew the difference between heading 940169 and 940171 before customs pointed it out.
The broker who knows your industry has seen the rulings, knows the port-level tendencies, and can tell you up front, this classification will probably hold at Long Beach, but Rotterdam will challenge it, so let's get a BTI before we ship. That conversation saves more money than any duty optimization strategy.
On the topic of money, the difference between a 0% rate and an 8.5% rate is often a single digit in a 10-digit code. The broker's fee is a rounding error compared to what a misclassification costs you.
The question that hangs over all of this, though, is whether any of that broker expertise is replaceable. There's a wave of AI tools now claiming to automate HS classification, feed in a product description, get back a 10-digit code. Natural language processing trained on past rulings and tariff schedules. And for straightforward products, they actually work reasonably well.
Straightforward products aren't where the money gets lost.
The AI can handle cotton t-shirt, 100% cotton, knitted. That's a clean match to heading 6109. But the moment you hit a composite good, a smartwatch with a medical-grade heart monitor, a drone with an integrated thermal camera, you're in GIR 3B territory. An essential character is a legal judgment, not a pattern match.
The AI doesn't know that the Port of Rotterdam has a reputation for classifying integrated LED luminaires differently than the Port of Hamburg. That's not in any training set.
It's not, and it may never be, because port-level interpretation culture isn't systematically documented. It lives in the heads of brokers who've been clearing goods through those ports for decades. Some of it is written down in internal firm memos and ruling libraries that aren't public. Some of it is just. The AI has no access to any of that.
The AI gives you the textbook answer, which is exactly what gets you flagged, because customs isn't grading on textbook answers. They're grading on their own interpretive precedent.
The 2027 HS revision is going to make this tension more acute. The WCO is introducing new headings for electric vehicles, advanced battery chemistries, AI accelerator hardware, categories that are still evolving technologically. There won't be a deep library of past rulings for the AI to train on. The first few years after a major HS revision, classification is negotiated in real time between brokers and customs officials, building the precedent that future rulings will cite.
The AI arrives exactly when the ground is shifting under it.
Which means the human broker who can walk into a meeting with a customs official and argue GIR-3B on a product category that didn't exist 5 years ago, that person is not just valuable, they're the only thing standing between the importer and a very expensive audit.
On that forward-looking note, Hilbert, I believe you have something for us.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, sailors off the coast of Madagascar reported seeing the night sky bloom green with auroras, a phenomenon later traced to oxygen atoms high in the atmosphere, excited by solar wind, whose characteristic green emission line at 557.7 nanometers is, chemically speaking, the same spectral fingerprint produced by fireflies trying to attract a mate.
Fireflies and the southern lights are basically running the same chemistry.
Different species, same wavelength. I'll allow it.
This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.